Welcome to the Sporting Spotlight here on Dublin City FM with me, Breffni Early. This week I am honoured by Irish sporting royalty, I think is probably the best thing to say. Himself an accomplished hockey player, having represented Ireland and Great Britain at international level with 229 international caps between the two, but also having won the Olympics with Great Britain in 1988 in Seoul, also a medal in Los Angeles. In bronze medal. Now, Los Angeles and Steve Martin is something that would come together, but it's Steve Martin, the CEO of the Irish Olympic Council. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Welcome, thank
First
you
of all, is it Steve or Stephen? Or I've seen
Actually,
Sam somewhere.
It's Steve. When I was working in England, it was Steve. When I'm here, it's Stephen. And when I'm in hockey terms, if you said Stephen Martin, some people would say, who's that? But if it was Sam, then they'd probably have more of an idea. Initials SAM, so from a very early age, in hockey terms, I was called Sam Martin, you know.
You grew up in Bangor, County Down. When did you get into hockey?
My passions were soccer and golf when I was younger, but I went to a grammar school, Bangor Grammar School, and of course the soccer option wasn't available then, so I played rugby for a few years, and then I got ill, and I was told actually that by a doctor that you'd probably never play sport again, which wasn't something you tell me because you know
I
love sport. I was around 13 years of age, so
pretty tough news to take.
So, yeah, but then I did a bit of cross country with the athletics group in second year, and in third year my brother had already started playing hockey at that stage, so I picked up a stick in the garden with him and we started to play. It just seemed that I took to it naturally because I had good hand-eye ball coordination, good sports person all around really. I started playing for the school team, and by the age of 18 or 19 I was playing representative senior level for Ireland.
It's a big step into the international team, particularly that age, even nowadays when the kind of strength and conditioning is so much better and the supports are much better. How big of a culture shock is that to go from being the average school kid playing hockey for the school to being in an international team?
Well, we had a progressive steps. You know, we in 78 in Dublin, the European Under-21 Championships were held, which we got to the final. We lost to Holland in the final, I think it was 6-3. And so that we then qualified for the first ever World Under-21 Championship. So we had some good experiences at a young age, and we knew we were just as good as the Dutch, the Germans, and in fact England at that time finished eighth in the Europeans, didn't even qualify for World Cup. So we had a really good bunch of players, and there were about four or five of us were sort of destined to go into the senior team. Again, you know, good coaching, and a lot of the senior players were very, very good in terms of helping you. Practice with them, learn, you know, to practice a high level for longer. And in terms of the training methods we used, you know, we got a lot of good advice from in developing speed and strength and so on from some of the track and field stars around that time, you know. So we looked outside the box, and there wasn't as wide a system of support as you would have now, but there was a good bit of support from within. There's a lot of experienced guys there, so it made it a little bit easier to make those first initial steps.
That cross-sport training that you would have mentioned, I know we look now at athletes like, say, Annalise Murphy, who's done a bit of triathlon and half Ironman distance stuff over the last few. Annalise, obviously, someone you'd be well familiar with from the games last year. That happens a lot nowadays. It wouldn't have happened in the early 80s, though.
Well, I suppose, you know, we learned a lot, and particularly with in hockey, in terms of, say, gameplay, we would have spent a lot of time talking to people in basketball and for indoor hockey, for example, you know, because the half court, full court, marking in front, marking side on, you know, some of the set play moves that they would use. So we actually could learn a lot from them. And obviously in some of the track and field areas, we even with the Weightlifting Association, you know, they would have helped us in terms of some of the programs we would have put together. It was always good. And obviously some of the rugby players around that time, Trevor Ringland, Nigel Carr, sort of my generation, we used to meet up in the gym, and whilst they would be lifting more because they had to, we would be lifting, you know, specifically. So we had a good program. But I suppose once you were in your sport, it was more a case of, you know, you couldn't really. I couldn't play so much golf anymore. I couldn't transfer. You were really sort of down this one channel.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the golf, and in some respects, it's quite similar to hockey in terms of it's a ball and a stick, but it's very different. You played golf to a pretty high level.
Yeah, I was single handicapper, and you know, at 14, I was going around my course in Donaghadee in 69, 200 par gross, and then I, when I started playing hockey, that's just where the focus was, and I can still go out now and hit, you know, 75, 76 on most courses without even having played for a while.
You say so, that like that's an easy thing to do. That's ridiculously difficult.
Well, you just, you know, a few swings, you get into the rhythm again, and, you know, as long as you don't think about it too much, you know, you it just comes. It does come. Our school golf team were very successful. We were Irish champions. We were Ulster champions. You're probably one of the names you would know who went on to play professional golf, David Fearty. We had a really good setup there. And in some ways, people say, do you have a regret for not keeping it on? In fact,
you're preempting all my questions.
I think I would have been a better golfer than a hockey player. But I can't complain, you know, because I love golf so much. But I rarely get the chance to, you know, to get into it because it does take time.
But at the time, late 70s, you're playing, or maybe mid 70s, you're playing a bit of golf, a lot of golf, and a bit of hockey. And obviously the career options in golf at the time would have been probably greater in terms of potential earnings, exposure, all of that sort of thing. Why the hockey rather than the golf?
I like the obviously like team sports, and I was successful, and I was progressing through, you know, the 18s, 21s, and senior teams, and getting a chance to go to European championships and World Cup qualifiers, and you know, it was just happening. I think if I had stayed in golf, I don't think there was the same, may not be the same opportunities as there are now in terms of earning money. It's very, very difficult, I suppose, to earn it. But I think my main strength is coping with the pressure and coping with the international sport. And that's why I think I would have been good at golf, because there are so many really good golfers, you know, to this day in Ireland. And you wonder why more of them don't do so well. I suppose half the battle, in fact, 90% is all mental. So I think I would have been able to cope with that. Got a semi-final against West Germany, as it was then. It was a nothing game. We just played really poorly, and so did Germany. And I think, in hindsight, we played poorly because we'd never been there before. We didn't know what to expect. We then played Australia in the bronze medal match. And, you know, they were pre-tournament favourites.
Because of the invitational nature of the competition at the time, even once you'd got in, was there an expectation that you would perform well? Or were you expected to be one of the weaker sides there?
You know, we were expected to finish in the top six, I'd say, but I don't think anybody expected us to win a medal. So interesting, before the Australian match, you know, we just picture we were in UCLA Village. It was one of the Olympic villages at the time. Pretty basic, but, you know, it was fine. You know, if you had 5 minutes free, you'd go and watch Seb Coe training on the track. You could, you know, there are lots of things happening just in your downtime. Even though you were sitting down, you weren't, you know, obviously on your feet too much. But we wanted to get back, before that bronze medal match, we wanted to get back to where we were at the start of the tournament. You know, free and easy, no expectations. So we persuaded the team management that we would go to a nightclub outside UCLA, which is, you know, near Hollywood. All these film stars were always inviting the athletes to come up after the competition. If you're finishing the first day, you had 2 weeks of a bit of fun, yeah. You know. So we're in from first day to last, so... We went up and he said, yeah, you can do that. You can have two beers, because we're off the beer for 5 months. You can have two beers. You're not allowed to dance.
You've got to sit and rest.
So you sit in a stool, watch, you know, world go by, and then come back down and you can go and see the Beach Boys, who were in concert in the Olympic Village that night, as long as you sit down and you leave early. Right, okay. And get to bed. So we had a practice day the next day, and then we had the bronze medal match the following day. So we just wanted to chill out. You know, that practice day the next day was just brilliant, because we were all back to where we were at the start.
We were buzzing.
Good night. Yeah. We were absolutely buzzing, you know. So, and we eventually beat Australia 3-2 in the bronze medal game.
You tell that story as an athlete back in 84 with your, I suppose, Olympic Council of Ireland hat on at the moment. How would you react if a team manager says, we're taking the lads to a Beach Boys concert and we're going to go for a few pints? How would that go down?
Yeah, well, it was two beers, no, it was two bottles of beer, okay. So it was probably one pint, you know, okay. Your views do change, you know, but I think sometimes, you know, people can get really serious, and I think if you've got a bit of emotional intelligence and you see that something, you need to do something which can relax people, then I'm not saying it has to involve alcohol, but everybody, you know, played along, and some people didn't take anything, but it was just the fact that we did something different.
Yeah, you know, because and the monotony relaxed. Is one of the issues that a lot of athletes talk about the Olympic Games, because all the public see is that person competing in their heat or their semi-final or their final or whatever the round games they might be in hockey or football or whatever it might be. But there's a lot of downtime at those events.
There is, and we actually talked a lot about that when we're athletes, and we obviously during your day would be maybe a pre-breakfast run. Light listener or whatever, have breakfast, and then you might have a team meeting on a particular aspect, whether it's penalty corner, attack, defence, or set plays or whatever. You might have had a practice on that day as well, then you have lunch. So the day's pretty much structured out. So in some ways, you've got to make sure you don't have any boredom. So if you're a reader, then you can read. If you want to listen to music, you listen to music, and you might have a nap in the afternoon. That's one of the things I miss, having a nap in the afternoon. But also in the village environment, we used to do things like, when tennis came in around 84, 88, and I remember Jim Courier was there, and he was... he was easy to talk to. Gabriel Sabatini, the tennis, tennis player.
I'm sure you struggled to talk to Gabriel Sabatini.
So at lunchtime, we just try to pick this, because a lot of the tennis players were on their own. They weren't really part, they weren't seen as being part of their group at that stage. So they'd be sitting on their own at the table. So why wouldn't you go over and talk to them? And they were more than happy to have the company. Mm. And you come away having had a chat with one of the top tennis players in the world, and made for an interesting day,
It's a talking point, something you can tell the grandkids about. Tell me about 88. Obviously, you've come in, you've had the experience of 84, you won the medal. Did you leave Los Angeles with the view that we're coming back and we're going to win it the next time? Was that an expectation, or was it just we want to do better? Or what was the mood in the camp?
It's a good question. I think after 84, there was a Champions Trophy, which is top six nation in the world, which was always the best tournament ever to play in. You've got Olympics, which is great. And the kudos of that, but actually in terms of hockey, top six nations playing, you could finish first or last. So in 84, we went to Pakistan after the Olympic Games, and thankfully we managed to keep our third rating, a ranking. We beat Holland 8 o'clock one morning for the bronze medal in the Champions Trophy. So we thought, okay, maybe we have something here. Maybe it wasn't just a flash in the pan. And we knew we had to be consistent then over the next period. So at Future Champions Trophy in 85, we won a silver in Perth. And people were then starting to, look at us and saying, well, you're really hard to play against. You're really our world class. And, anything's possible for you guys now. We kept a consistency. And just in the year before the games, there were a few people with injuries, a few people struggling with form. But in the main, the team that went to Los Angeles with maybe an average of 30-odd caps between them, we're now going into the Olympic Games. I think there was about 13 of the 16 again for the second tournament, with a lot more experience and desire and passion and belief and whatever in themselves, and a lot more support in the background as well. So the expectation going in, our ranking was number two, so we were ranked to win a medal. After the third game, the wheels nearly came off the bogey, and there are always little crisis points in any particular tournament, but we managed to get to semi-final. Curley scored a hat-trick and beat Australia, and then in the final we played Germany, and we liked playing Germany. We knew we could beat them, and their talisman leading goal scorer Stefan Bloscher, who was absolutely fabulous to play against, he was injured in their semi-final, so he wasn't playing, and we just knew this was it. We were destined to do well.
How do you prepare for an Olympic final? You've done all the work. You've spent years and years and years training to get to that level. You wake up in the morning of the Olympic final, and what's going through your head?
You try and keep a normal routine if you can. There's always a bit of banter, a bit of crack. You keep a routine, pre-breakfast, run, stretch, go for breakfast. You'll have your team meetings. Then you can't think about it all day, so you have to distract yourself. So you might go and read a book, listen to music, and take your mind away, and then when you have to switch on, you switch on, but otherwise you drive yourself crazy. There were the team meeting prior to the 84 bronze medal match and the team meeting before the 88 medal match, there were some very open, honest discussions and words said, which can't really tell you about right now, but everything was laid bare. Nobody was in any doubt why they were here, what their role was, and how important it was to come away with a win in 84 as well as an 88 in those medal games. So we were really pumped up.
Okay. We're going to take a little break from the kind of the business end of the interview and have a bit of fun with you for a few minutes. I know you've been looking forward to this. All our guests usually are. I'm going to ask a few sports questions. So how's your sports trivia?
Well, it depends on the questions.
Okay, well, let's give this a crack and see how we get on.
The game begins in 3, 2, 1.
What Irish county was Dennis Taylor born in?
County Tyrone.
Correct. What type of wood is a hurley made from?
Ash.
Yes. Which Irish golfer won the PGA Championship and the British Open in 2008?
Corey Carrington.
Correct. Belfast City Airport is named after which Irish sports star?
Say again?
Belfast City
Airport. Oh, George Airport. Best. George Best.
Tommy Paul Philip Nina, which Irish sporting family? You can pass if you don't know.
Say them again, Tom.
Tommy Paul Philip Nina. Which Irish sporting family?
I was going to say the Bows, but there's probably not.
No. Carberry, what record did Irish bobsledder Aoife Hoey set at the 2010 Olympics, Winter Olympics?
Well, I know she obviously qualified and she competed, and she finished ahead of the Australians. I'm not sure exactly what. It might have been a course record for the.
Okay, no. Which county has won the Sam Maguire Cup for Gaelic football 4 times more than any other county?
It's a difficult one. I would
have to get an answer from you. Gaelic football.
Gaelic football. Kerry?
Correct. That's 5. Not bad. Not bad. The 2 you didn't get. Tommy, Paul, Philip and Nina were the Carberry's horse racing family. And Aoife Hoey was the tallest female competitor at the Winter Olympics. Yeah. A bit of a trick question in there. But then I couldn't really give you an easy Olympic question because that would be your bread and butter. You did compete as the vice-captain in Barcelona in 92 and received an MBE. That's a pretty rare event.
I mean, after 88, my goal was to go back and captain the team. And it's one of these things you can't really say it, but I think a lot of the players afterwards say, well, you know, you should have been captain for longer and for other games as well. But you know, you leave that by the by. And I managed to captain the team, I think it was in 3 or 4 occasions during the Barcelona game. So that was achieved. And we finished 6th there. Unfortunately, I got a red card in my ultimate game, but couldn't play the last. But, you know, it was just another real goal. When I came back, I think it was around 1993, I got a letter to say that I was going to be awarded an MBE, which was fantastic because you can't go out and win those. You're nominated and for those awards. And I then learnt what MBE stood for, which is my bloody effort. OBE is generally for others' bloody effort. And I'll not tell you what the knighthood's for. But no, it was a special day. And I had the chance then that day as well to share it with my mum and dad, who've been great supporters, and my wife, Dorothy, as well, who were there. And it was a really, really special day.
You got the day out in Buckingham Palace?
Or? Yeah, it was a day in Buckingham Palace. And there were a few other sports stars there, people from all walks of life. And it was obviously a very set pattern to the day. But I think probably my parents enjoyed it more than I did, you know. But it was a good day.
In 2006, you took up your current role with the Irish Olympic Council, chief executive. So you're basically in charge of the day-to-day running of the office and kind of the direction of the organisation with the board of the OCI. And I suppose you work very closely with the likes of Pat Hickey on that. It was a very, I suppose, awkward time for the Olympic Council at the time because we're just coming out of the Athens Games, where of course Kian O'Connor had that situation with his horse failing the drugs test. What was the big challenges at the time?
I suppose what I was bringing with me was having worked in the GB system as deputy chief executive of the British Olympic Association, and at games time I would be the deputy chef of the team. You know, you're talking probably 20 odd sports go be away, up to 350 athletes, and then the same support staff. And 95 to year 2000, lottery funding then was provided to help sports, you know, dream their dreams. And there needed to be a system put in place in terms of development of how that was managed within the sport and within the government. The UK sport was established around that time as well. And then the institute started to form. So I suppose in a very short, if you think about it, people think of Britain finishing with 65 medals and finishing third in London. There was in a very short space of time, that was turned around. Now, money was one thing, but it was more a case of, you know, getting the right people at the right time and investing in the right areas, the right sports and so on. When I came to work for the Olympic Council of Ireland, you know, again, you were looking at, well, we haven't really won that many medals recently. How can we improve? Because in certain sports, we should be doing better. And I suppose it was a more of a collective wish and desire from the funding agency, the Sports Council, the Emerging Institute of Sport, and the Olympic Council, and obviously the national federations, to say, come on, you know, we can do something similar. Not 63 medals for London, but we should be looking around 5 to 6 medals on a regular basis and know where they're coming from before the even games start. And there may be a few sports that we could look at who could have potential, the likes of triathlon or modern pentathlon, and so on, and certain disciplines in other sports. And what about relays? Because they're a good opportunity. What about mixed doubles in badminton, for example?
Well, it's funny, you're naming sports, and immediately I'm putting faces to the sports. So you say modern pentathlon, you've got Natalia Coyle with a 9th place finish at the last games. Triathlon, Aileen Reid is probably the pretender to the throne there, even though Gavin Noble had a fantastic performance in London. Whether he'll be around in Rio or not at that level is another question. I'm sure he might have a different argument on that. But Aileen Reid is kind of the person coming through and getting the performances at international level. There are others with those athletes, but they're the two kind of that I would be seeing. Are we looking at them as finalists or medal prospects in Rio?
Well, certainly we want to make sure that they're fit and healthy and on the start line. And I think, you know, one of the good things over the last number of years is that, and that it'll continue to get better with the management of athletes from a coaching, from a science and medicine perspective and so on. Because we really have to make sure that the right athletes are getting the right support at the right time and have the right people around them. Because we have some very talented athletes here in Ireland across a number of sports. And they do well at Europeans and Worlds or World Cups and so on. And it's the trick is to try and, for those who have the potential to medal, to ensure that they're in that position to do so. You know, that's what I learned when I was an athlete. You know, if you keep yourself in a position where you have a chance, then someday you're going to get that opportunity, you're going to take it. Part of my job, I suppose, at the time was to try and work with like-minded people in the other organisation to believe that you could actually achieve something really special for Olympic sport in Ireland, and to say, you know, from experiences not too far away, look where they've come from. You know, one gold medal, 96, and now 63 medals. Of which I think about 26 were gold. So we've, you know, in Beijing, we had a good start with boxing, good program, 3 medals. And again, that program's obviously still progressing. Some great people and great athletes there. And 4 medals in London. And of course, Kane, it was fantastic to see him win a medal as well. But we had a number of, you know, nice 4th places. Annalise Murphy, you know, could have medalled. Robbie Heffernan was 4th. We were 5th in the team event in the eventing side, and Aoife Clark was 7th individually. And we had a number of top 10, top 15, top 20 performers. In fact, half the team finished in the top 20, which you don't necessarily hear about. And there were some disappointments. So I think overall we want to, I suppose, try and get more sports into the situation where we say, well, you're doing all the right things here, and it's just a matter of time before other medal opportunities happen. Maybe not necessarily at the Olympics, but to win medals at European level. It's good. Europe's a strong continent. And if you give the fact that there are 245 National Olympic Committees in the world, 80 of them medalled in London, only 80, and we were top 40. So, you know, if Joe Ward, for example, had got to the Games, you know, would have been a strong medal contender as well. So there's ifs and buts, but I think we're all pleased with the way the direction it's going. And there's still work to do.
The one thing from the public perception looking into to the whole setup of the team, over the last 10 or 15 years, there always seems to have been infighting within the team. That wasn't evident last year. Even on social media, you had each of the teammates, maybe someone from sailing supporting someone who was doing modern pentathlon, or someone from triathlon sending out a message to someone who was doing another sport. There just seemed to be quite a good team ethos. What was different about the team last year as opposed to previous games?
Well, certainly one of our focuses for the 4-year cycle is to try and develop a team, you know, a positive team culture from the team leaders, from the coaches, science and medical support, and particularly the athletes as well. So we spent a lot of time trying to make sure that we created a really good team ethos and positive high-performance environment. It just didn't happen by accident. You know?
It did. Having the likes of yourself and Sonia Sullivan, probably two of Ireland's greatest ever Olympians, involved at the upper levels of the squad, was that a factor in it, in your opinion?
I think so, because we were leading that. You know, that was one of our goals. You know, we've been away and we've seen how, either within your own sport or if you've had an opportunity to go to a multi-sport event, it's really important that there's a degree of respect for the environment that you're in. So yeah, we led that, and I think it was probably, I'd say if you ask some of the athletes, they'd probably give you a very strong positive opinion on that. When you're actually, you know, doing it and leading it, you don't think the same way, I suppose. But I had a really huge respect for all the athletes during the games, because they were exemplary in terms of their preparation, in terms of their performance. And yes, some did well, some didn't do as well as they might have hoped. But the way they went about their business was much more professional.
In terms of your own experience, having competed for both Ireland and Great Britain, obviously that situation can't exist anymore. It has been covered in the papers over the last maybe year, 18 months. Golf is coming into the games. We have a number of good golfers from the north of Ireland. We have seen maybe in last year where we had some rowers competing for Great Britain, born in Coleraine. We had other athletes who were born in the north, like Aileen Reid Morrison, who competed for Ireland. You've done both. Mm-hmm. The Rory McIlroy situation, what is the latest on that?
Well, there's no change. I mean, Rory, like a lot of the athletes, you know, he's no different to the other athletes who you've mentioned. Based in Northern Ireland, he can, because of the Good Friday Agreement as well, you know, he's got an option to compete at the games for whoever he chooses. And I think the again, going back to any athlete, you know, you want them to make sure that they're performing well and being top class. You know, he's had a few little blips recently, and but you just want the young guy to focus on being as best he can be, because whether you're from the north or south or east or west, whoever wants to try and own him, even at this time, it's nice to see somebody, you know, from Hollywood County down doing really well in golf, along with, you know, Graham McDowell, Shane Lowry, Broderick Harrington. You know, we have a lot to be proud of golf, but he'll make that decision. If he chooses Ireland, we'll respect that. If he chooses Britain, we'll respect that as well.
Is there a chance that he will pass on the Olympic Games because of the political ramifications?
Again, that's his choice. I think most people, you know, sport-loving people would like to see him compete in the Games. And obviously, we would love to see him compete for Ireland, you know, but we'll be respectful.
Stephen, thank you very much for coming in and joining us. It's been a pleasure to have you on the show. Best of luck on the road to Rio with all that the Olympic Council are doing, and hopefully you get back on the golf course a little bit as well. We do let our guest pick the song that plays us out. So what have you picked for us?
Well, the last concert I was at, I was dragged to by my wife. I was thinking, who am I going to see here? I didn't actually know the name of the person, but I knew her songs. And it actually turned out to be a really fun night. Paloma Faith was awesome in Belfast when I saw her in concert. So if you play New York, I'd be happy with that.
Okay, well, that's what we play the show out with today. My guest this week on the Sporting Spotlight was the CEO of the Irish Olympic Council, Stephen Martin, also a former Olympian, an Olympic champion in his own right in hockey with Great Britain back in the 88 games in Seoul, a bronze medalist in 84 in Los Angeles. It's been a pleasure to have him on the show. I've been Breffni Early. Don't forget, you can listen back to all of the series here on iTunes and on our website, www.sportingspotlight.com. I hope you enjoyed the interview, and we will be back next week. We're finishing the show with Stephen's choice of song, and it is New York from Paloma Faith.
The days were long and the nights so cold. The pages turned and the tale unfolds. He left me for another lady. She stood so tall and she never slept. There was not one moment he could regret. He left me for another lady.